Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Carmen.
And I'm Hendrik. Today we are diving into a world that's often misunderstood, the world of ancient women.
Between myth and reality, exactly. And I have to say, when I delved into this topic, I was surprised by how little we actually know, or rather, how much we think we know, that just isn't true.
That's a good point. Research has actually neglected this topic for decades. It wasn't until the 1970s, relatively late, that scholars began systematically examining the lives of women in antiquity. And it really gained momentum in the 80s and 90s.
And that's where the first problem lies, right? The sources we have. Who actually wrote them?
Men. Almost exclusively men. When we read about women in Athens, it's through the eyes of Aristotle, Plato, or playwrights like Euripides. It's as if you wanted to form an understanding of women today, but only men
were allowed to write about it. That distorts everything.
What we know as the ancient woman is often more of an idealized image or stereotype than reality. A picture that men had of women, not necessarily how women themselves actually lived.
And that's exactly why I find this topic so fascinating for us today. It's not just about history, but also about how we tell history, whose voices we hear, and whose we don't.
The notion of the ancient woman, that's a myth in itself. There wasn't the one role, not the one woman's life.
Because Greece wasn't a unified country.
Many people actually forget that. When we say ancient Greece, most people immediately think of Athens. But Greece consisted of, well, how should I put it, dozens of city-states, called poleis, each with its own laws, its own customs, its own ideas about what a woman could and couldn't do.
So basically like completely different countries, just in a small area?
Something like that, yes. And nowhere is this more evident than in the status of women. Take Athens. The ideal there was the secluded wife who practically never left the house, who lived in a separate area of the house, the gynaikonitis. And when you then compare that to Sparta...
It's completely different, right?
Spartan women trained physically, could own and inherit land, had significantly more freedom of movement. The state wanted strong mothers for strong warriors.
Oh, that's interesting. So not the oppressed ancient woman, but it totally depended on where you lived.
And when? Because then Rome comes into the picture, and there we see real change over the centuries. In the late imperial period, Roman women had significantly more rights than in the early Republic. They could own property, conduct business, had access to education.
So, three different models: the strict Athenian, the freer Spartan, and the evolving Roman?
In simplified terms, yes. And within each of these worlds, there were differences based on social class. A female slave in Rome lived a completely different life than...
an aristocratic matron. Of course, that makes sense.
That makes the picture more complex, but also much more fascinating. Because today, through archaeological finds, through inscriptions on tombstones, through papyri from Egypt, we can look much more closely than we could 50 years ago.
And that's exactly what we're doing in this episode. We're looking at what life was really like for women in Athens, Sparta, and Rome, beyond the stereotypes.
So we want to uncover the hidden stories behind the well-known stereotypes.
I'm looking forward to that. So, let's dive in.
Let's take a closer look at Athens, the city-state that most people envision when they think of ancient Greece.
And at the same time, the place with the harshest restrictions on women.
The polis, the city-state, was a strictly male sphere. Public and private life were completely separated. Men operated outside. Politics, trade, military. That was their domain. Women, on the other hand, were assigned to the oikos, the domestic sphere.
And this wasn't just a social expectation, but spatially organized as well. In some wealthy households, there was a separate women's wing, the gynaikonitis. Though how strict the separation was in daily life isn't entirely clear.
Upper-class women spent most of their
lives there, yes. And it wasn't just living space, but also workspace. Weaving, for example, was central. A skilled weaver was considered a good wife.
The lady of the house was responsible for providing the entire family with clothing. On top of that came managing the provisions, supervising the male and female slaves, raising the children.
So, certainly responsibility, but invisible, behind closed doors.
Freedom of movement was minimal. There were only a few legitimate reasons to leave the house. Religious festivals were one of them. Funerals, visits to other women.
But not just going to the market or taking a walk?
For wealthy women, no. That was done by slaves. The interesting thing is, and this is the point many people overlook,
that poorer women were much freer.
That's the great irony. The strict ideal of the secluded wife applied mainly to the upper class. Women from poorer circumstances had to work. They sold goods at the market, worked in workshops, in the fields. They didn't even have the option of staying shut in.
So poverty, paradoxically, meant more freedom of movement. The wealthy Athenian woman sat at home weaving, while the poor merchant woman was among people every day.
Which doesn't mean their life was easier, just differently constrained, by poverty rather than gilded cages.
And legally, what did that look like?
Women were under the guardianship of a man, the kurios, for their entire lives. First the father, then the husband, in widowhood the son or another male relative. No voting rights, no political participation. Independent land ownership was severely restricted. There were special cases, such as heiresses. They could have movable property. The dowry a woman brought into marriage legally remained the property of her birth family.
The kurios. So he was something like a legal representative?
More than that. He had legal authority over the woman. All public business, all legal matters went through him. A woman couldn't appear in court independently or sign contracts.
Basically, not legally competent.
The husband could initiate divorce relatively easily. Women could also divorce, but with significantly more hurdles. The children usually stayed with the father. That was an enormous means of pressure. Many women submitted because they didn't want to lose their children.
The picture we have of the Athenian woman, withdrawn, invisible, silent. So that's true for part of society, but it wasn't the whole truth.
There were areas where women definitely had influence. Religion, for example. Priestesses enjoyed high status. But that's a topic in itself.
And what about education? Could girls learn to read and write?
Limited. While boys received formal education, reading, writing, sports, music, girls mainly learned domestic skills from their mothers. Weaving, cooking, household management. Reading and writing were taught only rudimentarily, if at all.
So a system that systematically kept women from knowledge.
Yes. And that makes the contrast with Sparta all the more revealing. Because there, things looked completely different.
Sparta, that's like the counter model to Athens when it comes to women.
Absolutely. While in Athens, the ideal was the withdrawn, invisible wife, we see something completely different in Sparta. Spartan girls received formal education, and that included physical training.
And not just a little exercise. They trained seriously. Running, wrestling, javelin throw, discus. Publicly, together with other girls, sometimes even before spectators.
The training began early, probably around age 7, similar to the boys. And it continued until marriage. Parallel to the boys' agoge, there was an education system attributed to the lawgiver Lycurgus. But the girls stayed at home, so it wasn't as institutionalized as for the boys.
They also wore shorter garments than elsewhere, so they could move better.
Exactly. Which would have been unthinkable in other poleis. In Athens, that would have been considered scandalous.
And now comes the crucial point. Why was Sparta so different?
The military state. Sparta was a warrior society that subordinated everything to the goal of having the best army in Greece. And the Spartans believed that the mother's body was crucial for the physical quality of the children.
Strong, healthy women give birth to strong warriors. That was the logic. The physical training of girls didn't serve their own well-being, but the state.
Women were supposed to be robust, fearless, hardened, so they could better endure pregnancy and childbirth. And so they could raise their sons as mothers in the Spartan spirit.
But that's not really... I mean, the word emancipation doesn't really fit here. It was more like instrumental freedom?
That's very well put. The freedoms Spartan women had served a purpose. They were a means to the state's end, not an end in themselves.
That puts things into perspective considerably. They were freer than Athenian women, but this freedom didn't really belong to them.
But there were also tangible advantages. Spartan women could inherit and manage land. That was an enormous difference from almost all other Greek poleis. Even Aristotle complained that a large portion of Spartan land was in women's hands. Some scholars speak of up to 40%, but the exact number is disputed.
Because the men were so often at war?
Among other reasons. And because sons fell in war. Then the daughters inherited. This economic power was real, even though women remained politically excluded.
No voting rights, no political offices. That remained men's business even in Sparta. But within the household, in economic decisions, there Spartan women actually had influence.
And Sparta wasn't the only place with special women's rights. In Gorton on Crete...
Oh, the law code of Gorton.
That's one of the oldest surviving legal collections in Greece, carved in stone. And there we see... Women in Gorton could inherit and own land. They had rights in divorce, retained claim to part of the property.
So, regional differences after all. The picture of the Greek woman isn't just Athens.
And we shouldn't idealize even the Spartan model. A woman's main task remained bearing strong warriors. If a child was weak, it could be exposed. The society was brutal, for women too.
More freedom, yes, but at a price, and with a clear purpose that didn't put the woman herself at the center, but the state.
Rome. Here we see a completely different development than in Greece. Rome was also built on patriarchal lines. At the head of the familia stood the pater familias, the oldest male ancestor. He had far-reaching authority over all family members.
But still more room for women?
Significantly more. And above all, there was real change over the centuries. Roman society wasn't static. It evolved. We see this especially in the forms of marriage.
Manus marriage and sine manu marriage, right?
Manus literally means, well, hand or power. In the early Republic, a wife was under her husband's manus. That means she legally counted almost as his daughter. He had full authority over her property, over everything.
That sounds almost like the Kyrios system in Greece.
Similar, yes. But here comes the change. Over time, this form of marriage became rarer. A new form prevailed, sine manu marriage, meaning without this male power. And that changed a lot.
How so?
In sine manu marriage, the woman retained her legal connection to her birth family. She remained, so to speak, her father's daughter, not the husband's daughter. That meant strict separation of property applied. Her own property remained completely under her control. Only the dowry was managed by the husband in daily life, but even that could be reclaimed in a divorce.
That's an enormous difference.
Toward the end of the Republic and in the imperial period, Roman women could then
appear as parties in court. I read that. They could sign contracts, conduct business.
Or correct. They could buy and sell real estate, engage in trade, pursue lawsuits. Some managed enormous fortunes completely independently. That would have been unthinkable in Athens.
But political offices remained close to them?
Political offices and voting rights, yes. That was the boundary that wasn't crossed even in Rome. But within that boundary, significantly more scope for action than anywhere else in the ancient world.
And yet there was an ideal, right? The matron.
The matrona, the honorable, virtuous wife and mother. That was the ideal. And the most famous example of this is Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi.
I know her by name. What made her so special?
Cornelia lived roughly from 190 to 100 BC. She was the daughter of Scipio Africanus, the general who defeated Hannibal. Highly aristocratic, well-connected. She had 12 children, though only 3 reached adulthood. 2 sons, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, later became famous tribunes of the people.
And she taught them herself?
She didn't just teach them. She directed their entire education, hired Greek philosophers as teachers, was herself highly educated. Letters circulated under her name that Cicero and Quintilian praised as stylistically exemplary, the only surviving prose text by a Roman woman from the Republic at all, though the authenticity is disputed today.
There's that one story with the jewelry, right?
The most famous anecdote about her. A wealthy Roman woman was visiting and boasting about her jewels. When she asked Cornelia where her jewelry was, Cornelia pointed to her sons and said, "Hic ornamenta mea sunt. These are my jewels."
Oh, that's of course a perfect ideal. The selfless mother who sees her worth in her children, not in material wealth.
She received a public statue, one of the very few women to be so honored. The inscription read simply, "Cornelia, mother of the Gracchi." This honor was otherwise reserved only for statesmen and war heroes.
So an ideal that also meant power, influence through education, through raising the next generation.
And an ideal that also changed. In the late Republic and the imperial period, we see women who actively participated in public life. As benefactors, as patronesses of art and science, some even with considerable political influence behind the scenes.
Not a static society then.
And that's what makes Rome so interesting. The development over centuries, the legal changes, the gradual expansion of opportunities, even though voting rights never came.
There was one area where women in antiquity actually had real power. And that was religion.
That's a fascinating, exceptional area. Precisely in the religious context, where you might not necessarily expect it, we find women in positions with real influence. Even in Athens, where they were otherwise so restricted.
The most famous example from Greece is, of course, the Pythia.
The Oracle of Delphi. The Pythia was the mouthpiece of the god Apollo. And when I say influence, I mean kings, generals, statesmen travel to Delphi to consult her. Her prophecies influence political decisions, wars, colonial foundations.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Croesus asked her whether he should go to war against the Persians. Sparta asked for advice before the Persian Wars.
The answers were often ambiguous. That was part of it. But the Pythia's authority was not questioned. She spoke for the god. That made her untouchable.
And even in Athens, there were powerful priestess offices. The priestess of Athena Polias on the Acropolis, for example.
She had prohedria, honorary seats in the theatre and at public festivals, a privilege otherwise reserved exclusively for men. She had access to the Acropolis and to the cult statue of Athena, to sacred spaces that remained completely closed to other women.
Religion as a gateway into the male world.
But the absolute prime example of female power in a religious context are the Vestal Virgins in Rome.
The six priestesses of the goddess Vesta.
They were chosen as girls between 6 and 10 years old from the noblest families of Rome. And then they served the goddess for 30 years. 10 years of training, 10 years of active service, 10 years teaching the younger ones.
30 years of chastity. That was the condition.
Their main task was tending the sacred fire in the temple of Vesta. The Romans believed that as long as this fire burned, Rome was safe. If it went out, disaster threatened the city. The Vestal Virgins thus symbolically carried Rome's welfare on their shoulders.
And for that, they received privileges that
no other woman in Rome had. They could own property completely independently. They could testify in court without taking an oath, a sign of how unimpeachable their word was considered. They had their own lictor who preceded them, an honorary guard otherwise reserved only for high officials. And they could save condemned criminals from execution.
Wait, save? A Vestal Virgin could spare someone from execution?
If a condemned person on the way to execution happened to encounter a Vestal Virgin, she could spare his life, provided she swore under oath that the meeting was not intentional. At least, that's what Cassius Dio reports. A ritual privilege, not a plannable right of pardon.
That's enormous power. Over life and death.
The flip side, however, was brutal. A violation of the vow of chastity was seen as treason against the state. The punishment was death, specifically being buried alive.
Because a Vestal Virgin's blood couldn't be shed?
That was the reasoning. They would lower her into an underground chamber with some food and a lamp, and then the entrance was sealed. In all of Roman history, this is recorded in maybe a dozen cases. The most famous scandal was in 114 BC, when 3 Vestal Virgins were punished at once. The sources are incomplete, but it was definitely rare, though the threat always loomed.
Besides these official cults, there were also other religious spaces open to women. The mystery cults.
Eleusis?
The Eleusinian Mysteries, yes. The cult of Demeter and Persephone was open to both sexes. Initiation promised a better life after death. That was incredibly important for many people in antiquity. And here, women were equal participants.
And then, of course, the cult of Isis, which spread from Egypt throughout the Roman Empire.
Isis was considered the protector of women and children. In her cult, women could hold priestess offices. It was a spiritual alternative to the male-dominated state religion. Many women found there a religious home that traditional cults couldn't offer them.
So religion is one of the few areas where the boundaries between the sexes were more permeable.
At least partially. And with the Vestal Virgins, we see that real institutional power was possible, even if the price for it was high. Now we come to a particularly revealing point. Because when we look at how women were economically active in antiquity, it breaks down some prejudices.
Absolutely right. The image of the ancient woman who just sits at home weaving, that's not accurate. At least not for everyone.
In Greece, many women worked as merchants in the markets. They sold food, textiles, pottery. Well known, for example, were the garland makers in Athens.
They made flower garlands for religious festivals and symposia, a profession dominated by women.
Textile production especially. Spinning and weaving were considered typically female activities. But it wasn't just housework. It was production for the market.
And there were also women in professions you wouldn't really expect. A painter named Iaia of Cyzicus was active in Rome in the 1st century BC. She was known for her portraits.
A painter? That's remarkable.
In Rome, women had even more opportunities. The legal development from manus marriage to sine manu marriage created the framework for it. Women could own property, inherit, conduct business. And they did.
And what's fascinating is we have concrete evidence of this. Pompeii is a gold mine for this kind of thing.
Archaeologists found there
wax tablets. Two tablets from a certain Dicidia Margaris from the Jucundus archive. She was a businesswoman involved in moneylending and trade. We know her name, we know what she did.
And not just her. In Pompeii, they also found electoral notices, political campaign graffiti on house walls, in which businesswomen endorsed political candidates. The baker Aselina, for example.
Aselina, who ran a tavern or bakery. And she publicly recommended candidates for political office. So here we see both economic and social influence.
She couldn't vote herself, but she had enough standing and clientele that her recommendation mattered.
That completely changes the picture. These aren't nameless women in history. These are concrete people with concrete businesses.
A particularly, well, a very well-documented example is Terentia, Cicero's wife.
I know her as a political figure, but economically?
She managed a considerable fortune completely independently, conducted real estate transactions, invested. Cicero writes several times in his letters about her financial activities. She wasn't a passive recipient of wealth. She was an active estate manager.
And in Egypt, there are papyri that show
that women owned weaving workshops or oil mills, real production facilities.
So not just trade, but also production.
The archaeological finds of recent decades have enormously changed our picture. Grave goods reveal much about status and activities. Inscriptions on tombstones name women as founders, as patronesses, as business owners.
The famous Celsus Library in Ephesus was endowed by a son for his father. But there were also women as benefactors. Eumachia in Pompeii financed a large building on the Forum. Public patronage at the highest level.
So such female benefactors really existed.
And that leads us to the question, where did this wealth come from? The answer often lies in dowries and inheritance.
In Greece, women brought a dowry into marriage. While it was managed by the husband, it had to be returned in case of divorce. A kind of safeguard.
And in Rome?
In Rome, women could inherit and manage their wealth themselves. Particularly in the upper classes, this meant that some women possessed enormous wealth. And they used this wealth for business, for endowments, for social influence.
The image of the exclusively domestic ancient woman, that's only half the truth. Archaeological finds show us the other half. Women as active economic participants.
With names, with faces, with stories we can now tell. If we look back on everything now, what emerges?
That the ancient woman didn't exist. What we've seen is enormous diversity, depending on culture, region, social class, and era. The life realities were completely different.
An upper-class Athenian woman lived in a different world from a Spartan landowner, and both again in a different world from a Roman businesswoman of the imperial period.
What's also important is that our picture for a long time
was shaped by male authors. The ancient sources we have come almost exclusively from men, and they wrote about women from their perspective, with their prejudices, with their ideals.
That means we have to read these sources critically. What Aristotle or Xenophon wrote about the ideal wife was an ideal, not a description of reality.
And this is precisely where research of recent decades has changed so much. Archaeology provides us insights that no literary source can offer. Grave goods, inscriptions, everyday objects, they tell different stories.
Stories of merchants and businesswomen, of priestesses with real political influence, of benefactors of public buildings.
Yeah, and that differentiates our picture enormously. Obviously, women, despite all restrictions, and they were real and often harsh, repeatedly found ways to actively participate in their societies.
What I personally take away from this topic is, I think, this caution against generalizations. If someone says, in antiquity, women were oppressed, period, then that's too simple.
It was more complicated. There was oppression, yes, but there were also opportunities for action. There was change over time. There were regional differences.
And why is that important for us today?
Because it shows us that societies are never as uniform as we sometimes imagine them, and that change is possible. Roman law evolved over centuries. Women gained more rights, more opportunities. That didn't happen on its own. It was a process.
History is never static, not even in antiquity.
And the more closely we look, the more we dig, literally, the more nuanced the picture becomes. The research isn't finished. Every new find can expand our understanding.
That's what makes history so alive. There's always something more to discover.
And with that, we've reached the end of this episode. I hope we were able to give you insight into the multifaceted world of ancient women, between myth and reality.
If you found this topic interesting, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. There, you'll find not only an extensive selection for everyone who wants to experience history vividly, but also many more fascinating articles on historical topics in the blog.
Thanks so much for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.